This episode of the Real-Time History Podcast is sponsored by Nebula. Subscribe to Nebula to listen to this podcast and watch all our real-time history videos earlier and ad-free. You also get access to exclusive historical deep-dive documentaries like our World War II series 16 Days in Berlin and Rhineland 45 on the dramatic and decisive final stage of the Second World War. Sign up for Nebula at nebula.tv/realtimehistorypodcast for just $30 for an entire year and support this show.
And so East Germany ended up basically this resources pool for the Soviet Union, and that was what Bart Olbrich was supposed to facilitate. But as he was an East German communist, he wanted a genuine East German state there that functioned and did its own thing and took this way further than Stalin would have liked.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Real-Time History Podcast. I'm Jesse Alexander, and today we have a repeat guest again. We have with us Katja Hoyer, who's an historian and journalist, who's a visiting fellow at King's College in London. She's also the co-host of, if I may say so, the deliciously named Tommy's and Jerry's podcast on Anglo-German affairs. And she's the author of an excellent popular history of Imperial Germany called Blood and Iron, which is, of course, sitting on my own bookshelf in Vienna. But she's also got a new book coming out, this time about the history of the German Democratic Republic, the GDR. And it's called Beyond the Wall, East Germany, 1949 to 1990. Katja Hoyer, thank you very much for accepting my invitation and joining me today.
Hi, Jesse. It's great to be back on your podcast.
I want to start off, and I think this is going to be a theme for us today. We're talking about East Germany, which is the subject, especially outside of East Germany, of a lot of preconceptions, I think, some of which I have shared, I will admit, over the years. And I think it's fair to say that quite a lot of people associate East Germany with, you know, the Berlin Wall, the Stasi, female athletes on steroids. And I was wondering how I should put this, but I think I'll put it as general drabness is something that might come to mind. No offense to all the former East Germans out there. I'm talking about non-outside preconceptions. And of course, maybe there are some hipsters in Berlin who also kind of get nostalgic about the aesthetic of the art and architecture and that sort of thing. But there is, of course, a lot more to the story than that. So to get the ball rolling, if I were to ask you, what are we outsiders missing when we think about East Germany? Like, what do you want people to know about the GDR when they're done reading this book?
So the idea with the title, I think, sums it up quite nicely. So this idea that there's more to Germany than the wall and Stasi and, you know, barbed wire and drabness and greyness and all these other cliches. So the idea is that, you know, I'm taking the story of the GDR beyond the wall, kind of both physically and kind of metaphorically, if you will, and look at the country as a whole, what was life like in it, what was kind of the general idea behind the state in the first place. I'm trying to take it seriously, basically, as a political, social and economic experiment that lasted, you know, 41 years and isn't just kind of a footnote, if you will, of Cold War history, but these are the life experiences of millions of Europeans, of Germans, that I think can't just be written off with these kind of very simplistic, flat images that we have of that time. So I'm trying to go into lots of kind of micro histories of individual lives, individual peoples, but also into the big story of what the state went through. Trying to show more facets, basically, of the state and of its people than are normally perceived by most outsiders.
Yeah, I think you touched a bit on the sources, the kinds of sources that you use, which involve a lot of personal stories. And you did some interviews for the book as well. What, if I may ask, is there one particular interview that sort of sticks in mind that you did for the book? Someone who you interviewed who you kind of end up, now that the book is done, still maybe thinking back to from time to time?
Mostly actually older people who I spoke to. So there were some people who were born sort of in the late 30s or in the early 1940s who have therefore experienced the entire state. And I think that's quite a rare experience to have, sort of to be there when a state's formed and still be there when it dies. And having kind of this as part of your biography, I found really quite fascinating. So there was, for instance, a woman called Regina Faustmann, who was a teenager in the sort of early period of the GDR. So she had experienced the war itself and had lost her dad, who sort of came back from a prisoner of war camp, but really wasn't the same person anymore. And she said, like, he might as well not have been there, and tried to rebuild her life with her mother. And then actually, instead of sort of giving up and having this cynical attitude, she was one of this kind of generation of young East Germans who just wanted to roll their sleeves up, get going, start clearing the rubble away and build this kind of new Germany, was genuinely enthusiastic about it. At the same time, she was not an ideologue like most people. You know, she just wanted to live a decent life, go to work, you know, found a family. But also she did have this kind of idea that there needed to be a different Germany, you know, given that she'd seen the destruction caused by Nazi Germany, effectively. So, you know, despite being not what you'd associate with sort of typical East Germans, so she was Catholic, for example, grew up in a fairly conservative household, but ended up being a sort of lab assistant in a tire factory, having a job of her own, getting married, and then living a sort of normal life, if you will, in the GDR. And I think it's those kinds of stories that, despite being not kind of dramatic in any shape or form, are very closely linked to the fate of the state and show us that kind of people had normal lives, had ambitions and had kind of their own personal ambitions as well as ideas as to how the state should be run.
I think that's one of the things that makes a history book accessible, is when it kind of combines those different levels of individual stories plus the development of, you know, the structures in society and how and the state. And one of the interesting kind of ways that you put it in the book that seems obvious in retrospect, but I hadn't really thought about it that way before, is that you make the observation that Germany was separated for about a third of its history as a state, sort of going up to 1990, right, when it was then reunified. So 1871 to 1990, about a third of that is this 40-year, this four-decade separation, which is a long time in history, especially in modern history, when we've got lots of sources, but it's a long time. And despite that, I feel like, again, as outsiders, we tend to look at the GDR as kind of unchanging, like stuck in those sort of cliches that I mentioned before. What were some of the different phases of the GDR? Like, the society changed over time. Of course, the wall is one kind of marker, right, where things were quite different before and after. But how did you handle those changes in the state?
Yeah, it's definitely one of the big misconceptions I wanted to address. I mean, when you look at, say, all the micro histories that have been done about, say, the Weimar Republic or Nazi Germany, you know, they have sort of a decade or a bit more to deal with. And yet there's kind of the early Weimar Republic, the golden years, you know, the Wall Street crash and all of that. And people look at that as distinct phases, even though they're only a few years long. And somehow you got this four-decade-long, you know, political experiment that's supposed to be one great big block. So I did it as a chronological study because I think if you come into this as an outsider, it makes sense to understand how the GDR evolved across its time. So there's this early phase in the 1950s after, so it gets set up as a state in 1949. And its first decade in the 1950s is very much a consolidation phase. It's really, really shaky on all levels, politically, economically. The state's really struggling to even exist as a state. And this, I think, sets the foundation to some extent psychologically for the elites as well, in that they're constantly fighting for survival. The Soviets aren't really all that keen on it, and they see it as a kind of resource bank, but not something that they want to look after, not a kind of, you know, another thing that they have to prop up and look after when they're struggling so much themselves economically and politically. And at the same time, you've got West Germany and its Western allies, particularly the US, which now see West Germany as a part of their own bloc, you know, trying to reunify Germany under that banner, which of course the East German socialists aren't keen on. So you got this early phase of consolidation and people really wanting to get going, East Germans in particular, like those people, young people in particular, but also it doesn't really work. You know, you get this kind of mass uprising, for instance, in 1953, 1 million East Germans on the street demonstrating for better living conditions and working conditions mostly, but also more democracy. So it's really a shaky period. And then when you skip forward and you look into the 1970s, for example, it's sort of calmed down a bit. You've got the highest living standards in the communist world in East Germany. People haven't, of course, quite got the same, say, technical standards, for instance, as in the West, and not the same consumer goods and so on and so forth. But they're not starving. They're living in you know, half decent housing. They're kind of reasonably safe and set up, and are now beginning to focus more on sort of cultural things and kind of just living their lives, going on holiday, that kind of thing. So you really see a change, I would say, from, you know, the early years to the later years. And then in the 80s, this kind of sense that progress isn't sustained and the GDR is stagnating and beginning to crumble, particularly economically, but also politically, where people are now saying, well, look, we've achieved all of this. Where are we going next? And there isn't really a vision to modernize, to take things forward. So I've tried to highlight those phases in the book as I go through the GDR's history chronologically.
Yeah, you heard it here first, folks. The GDR is more than, you know, the socialist boogeyman, and it's more than those GDR t-shirts that you can find for sale at all the flea markets and creative artist markets and things in Berlin here, where I'm sitting right now at a GDR era desk, I will say, as well. So it's kind of an appropriate setting, I think. But you mentioned the connection to the Soviet Union, and that is an important, clearly a very important theme in the history of the state, but also in the way that you've constructed the book. I mean, you start with talking about German communists who've gone to the Soviet Union in the 1930s, and then some of them are the ones who come back and are involved in the founding of the East German state. And this made me think of another assumption that I was, I think, subconsciously making, which is that the GDR was passive. It was just a satellite state of the Soviet Union occupied by Soviet troops. And I didn't really think of it, I realize now, as kind of having its own agency, developing its own foreign policy or domestic policy. To what extent was it able to do those things despite being essentially under Soviet control in some way, shape, or form?
Yeah, I mean, it was always dependent on Soviet goodwill, not least because initially in its kind of early phase in the first two decades, it wasn't able to trade, for example, with the West. So West Germany had the so-called Hallstein Doctrine, which was basically a foreign policy idea that anybody who wanted to trade with West Germany or have diplomatic relations with it could not do the same thing with East Germany. So if you're like Great Britain or the US, you're not going to snub this kind of mighty West German export economy just so you can have toys from the GDR. So that was one problem. And this meant that the GDR was constantly looking, because it can't be an independent economy, not least because, you know, stuff doesn't grow, obviously, not all of it in East Germany. The famous bananas were constantly, for instance, out of stock and had to be bought on the world market. So therefore, you know, they needed to look to the Soviet Union for goods, for energy, for example, you know, oil, gas, and all sorts of other things. And that was made them dependent on it, for one thing. And then, of course, ideologically, it remained the role model still. But East German communists certainly had their own agenda. So you've got people like Walter Ulbricht, for example, who spent the war in Russia and then was sent back to Germany in 1945 on the very same day that Hitler shot himself in the bunker to set up a new Germany on Stalin's behalf. But interestingly, he had very, very different ideas as to what to do with that. So Stalin, for instance, what he wanted out of Germany was resources, making sure that, you know, the Soviet Union was on its knees after the Second World War. They needed to get everything out of Germany that they could. And now they had to, because of the way that the Potsdam Agreement worked in terms of reparations, they had to take this out of their own zone largely. And so East Germany ended up basically this resources pool for the Soviet Union. And that was what Walter Ulbricht was supposed to facilitate. But as he was an East German communist, he wanted, you know, a genuine East German state there that functioned and did its own thing, and took this way further than Stalin would have liked. So, for example, when these kind of early policies of land redistribution, for example, where they take huge pieces of land away from the Prussian aristocracy and make it into tiny little plots that don't really work economically, goes terribly wrong. Stalin actually gets him back into Moscow, and, you know, like a naughty schoolboy, and says, can you just stop doing this, because it's not working? We need to get things out of here, and your policy is making this worse. To the point where he tells them to stop using words like communist, socialist, and so on, you know, and just tone the rhetoric down a little bit. And Ulbricht is always keen to push this as far as he can, and there you can see that. And then equally later on, you end up with, for example, Erich Honecker, the second general secretary leading the state, wanting to make quite close relations with West Germany and making sure that more trade, for example, and more cultural collaboration between the two German states can happen, which then frightened Moscow to a point, you know, because they thought the GDR would become this intermediary between Moscow and Bonn, where they were actually telling Honecker, you can't even go to West Germany to visit, you know, on a state visit, that's not happening. So there are constantly these like phases within the relationship between the GDR and the Soviet Union, where they want different things out of their relationship and the GDR is kind of trying to do its own thing.
I mean, I think if Stalin is telling you to tone it down, it's probably time to tone it down. I'm pretty sure if there's a constant in the history of the time when Stalin was in charge of stuff, it's probably that. I think on that note, on the note of Stalin and the relationship with the Soviet Union and this ideological sort of straitjacket, if you will, I think also that we focus a lot on, well, I guess for lack of a better word, clearly what we could call the negatives, right, connected with the GDR, like the dictatorship and how it functioned, or the secret police and how they functioned. But, you know, there are these other threads running through the story that don't quite fit with that picture. For example, the GDR had the highest quality of life from among the Eastern Bloc countries. So what were some of the, I don't know, state policies or programs, or like the way that citizens decided they want to have certain cultural practices that contributed in a positive way to their life? Yes, under this dictatorship, but they have normal lives and they want to be healthy and they want to have send their kids to school. So how were they able to achieve a better quality of life than the other Eastern Bloc countries, basically?
Well, I think one of the things that worked really well, although they did this in the other Eastern Bloc countries as well, is like social mobility, if you want to phrase it like that. So this idea that if you are a working class German, and Hitler didn't really do much for you. I mean, he tried, obviously, with various holiday programs and other things, but he was never really able to win over the working classes. He always had most of the support from the middle classes upwards. The Weimar Republic promised to do things differently. And yes, they did have a huge welfare system, but it broke down because the economy wasn't there to support it. So you were still poor and in very precarious work conditions. You were still not able to get into the higher education system. Only 7% of kids in the Weimar Republic from working class backgrounds managed to get into the sort of higher stream schools, the gymnasium. So none of that, those promises that were made previously, fulfilled themselves. And the German working classes had been fighting basically since Marx in the, you know, middle of the 19th century to try and get something out of this German state for themselves. And now they had a genuine chance, many failed to do that. Because their work was valued. You'd actually have, I would say, that the sort of highest social status that you could achieve wasn't so much kind of being a university professor or being, you know, kind of these jobs that we now associate with sort of relatively high prestige. But actually, if you were a skilled worker and you had, say, you were like a master in your trade, say you were, I don't know, a carpenter, people really valued that. And you got sort of medals and rewards for that. You got a higher pay than people in sort of white collar positions. And you suddenly were somebody in society. You were recognized for the work that you did. And this is something, for instance, that many people felt very disaffected about once, you know, the GDR collapsed and this kind of prestige status that came with these things went. You could also, if you were very good at your job, somebody would say to you, you know what, you're a really good mechanic, don't you want to go and do an engineering degree? You know, and the state would sort of fund that and it was possible to do that even in adult age. For women, you could have a career and children at the same time because the childcare system was so comprehensive and the state genuinely tried to sort of, you know, get women into the same positions as men and was trying to do that for ideological reasons, not just for economic reasons. And the GDR achieved the highest rate of female employment in the world ever, with over 90% of women in full-time employment, 50% nearly of university students were female and at sort of undergraduate level. So, you know, there was genuine social progress in the way that the West took much, much longer to go in the same direction.
Yeah, I mean, I think that reminds me of, I don't know, part of the limitation of that as well. At the same time, I was thinking of a former colleague of mine who ended up as, you know, a high school teacher, and she wanted to study and do something else, but she ran afoul of the authorities for expressing her political views. And so that they sort of capped her social mobility for political reasons. So it's a complex mix there, I think. I also want to tease out one other tangent from what you said. For all our listeners out there, Hitler was not able to completely win over the working class. So for those of you out there arguing that he's a socialist, think again, my friends. I'm just going to leave it at that. I won't go down that rabbit hole too far, but I couldn't let that opportunity pass. But I want to get back to the swimmers that I mentioned.
Of course you did.
naturally. I'm thinking of 8-year-old Jesse sitting in front of the TV in Canada for the Seoul Olympics in 1988. And every swimming competition is like East German wins, East German wins, East German wins. And I'm sitting there thinking, these East German women don't look like the women that I see around me in Canada every day. I mean, they were very good swimmers, but also appeared different. And you could tell that the state drug program, even though I didn't realize it at age 8, but you could see the evidence of that quite clearly. But something that you talk about in the book is that sport was more than just this kind of state doping program to win gold medals at the Olympics. It played an important cultural and social role in the GDR. So could you tell us a bit more about the role the sport played beyond what we all know about really muscular swimmers?
I mean, I'm not trying to take away from that at all. And there's a fair amount in the book as well about kind of state-sponsored doping programs, because they do, of course, play a role. And some women, although not all, it should be said as well, a lot of women willingly participated in this as well because they wanted the sporting career. Some didn't. Some weren't told that this was happening to them, and they were kind of just given these drugs against their will, even from a very, very young age, and had their physique sort of permanently altered by these. So all of that is there. But at the same time, sport was a huge thing. So I was only 3 years old when somebody sort of measured all my limbs and my climbing abilities and all of that, and decided that I would be a very good gymnast because I'm very compact, and decided that, you know, I was put into a program like this without drugs at this point, I should say, because they just, you know, basically decided at sort of 3-4 years old that might be a good thing for you to do. And you were really kind of trained. I had, for instance, training like several afternoons a week, even at that age, where, you know, they built up your muscle structures accordingly and, you know, put you on all sorts of physical enhancement programs and things like that. At the same time, it was also a huge social thing. So even, say, if you wanted to study stuff at university, you had to continue with sports, and in those sports clubs, you'd also have like a bar in there. People would celebrate their birthdays in the facilities that were available there. And it became like a sort of community almost around sports. So you'd be, say, in your football club, in your local, in your community, for way longer than as there's normal kind of in Western countries. You stayed there. You started there at school age, say, and you were still there through university and then afterwards. And even when you're sort of 40, you know, people would still play football for the fun of it with their mates and have a beer afterwards. And these kind of communities stayed in place as well. It played a social role. It was just the case that throughout your entire life, you'd be kept in contact and in touch with sport, whether you were good at it or not, one way or another, you still had something to do with it. And this then just meant that, say, with the swimmers, they had a much, much wider range of people to choose from, because there were so many people, you know, at age 3, where somebody decided they were physically in quite a good kind of position to become a really good swimmer. They then had loads of children where they could say, you know, actually only these 5% are going to go into the next higher program, and so on and so forth. And yes, then you add kind of the state sponsored drugging to that, but at the same time, they would have already been very, very good athletes to start with. And so it's once again a case of the story is a lot more complicated, I think, than you look at it from the outside. And of course, state sponsored doping happens in other states as well at the same time, which is just not kind of the main story that people highlight. But there's no doubt that sport had a political dimension in the GDR too, not least because they needed to build a national consciousness out of nowhere. I mean, this kind of inner German division is completely random in 1949. And to create like an East German identity, sport is a good vehicle to do that, because you're then kind of, you know, cheerleading for your local, your national team, as it were, and it makes you consciously East German. And so, you know, athletes were constantly told, you're on a political mission here, make sure that you win, you know, for our country. And they were given medals and things like this for their efforts if and when they won. But the sporting success cannot alone, I think, be explained through doping. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. You know, compact frames also make for good weightlifters. So you never know. You never know who was involved in your selection. Could have gone a totally other direction at some point. I want to get back a bit to that political side of things and the regime. I have the impression that the instinct for many of us is to think of the regime as so rigid, so ideological, that it made it sort of stupid. And that when things started to break down in 1989, that the regime was taken by surprise and was completely helpless because it was made stupid by its ideological obsession, if I want to exaggerate a little bit, that kind of view from the outside. So when the collapse comes, they have no idea what's happening. But of course, and I think this is going to be the theme of the whole podcast, it seems to be, if I understand right, a little bit more complex than that. You cite, for example, which I thought was quite interesting, that they knew in the 1980s, the governing authorities knew that they were starting to become separated from the population, that problems were growing. There was a report in 1988 that even predicted like a massive detachment between the people and the government was in the near-term future. So how much did the government know, and what were they talking about, and how were they trying to do something about that? Even though, of course, they ultimately failed.
Yeah, I think there are people confused, and I think this is the problem here. The government as a whole, like all of the people in the Socialist Unity Party, who are sort of the ruling party, with the General Secretary. So when you look at, you know, the late 1980s, you look at a very frail, somewhat confused and disorientated Erich Honecker, who was very old at this point and in very bad health, particularly throughout 1989 when it's all kicking off. Most of the time he's in hospital. You know, people suspect that he's got cancer, he's undergoing an operation, and he's barely there throughout the summer of 1989. And when he appears, you know, he says really kind of, you know, silly socialist kind of paroles from the 19th century and things like that. So he just seems out of touch. And years out of touch at this point completely. But behind him, you know, there's a huge party with millions of members in it who are trying to change things. So just because you're in the SED, in the ruling party, it doesn't mean that you are Erich Honecker or you're following everything that he says. I mean, people have been pushing for him to go and to change things for a long time. And the fact that this doesn't happen makes a lot of people very angry, and they're pushing for reform. So these reports, for instance, that you mentioned, they get commissioned by people within the system who then analyze them and look into them and say to Honecker, we need to do something because otherwise the system is going to collapse. And it's the reluctance to do something at the top by the people who've been there, you know, for the entire history of the GDR and are now not flexible enough to respond to these things. That is the problem, I think, with it. But people are very well aware of the fact that there is a problem that needed to be addressed. It's just that, you know, the elite kind of didn't respond to it.
Yeah, I think one image that sticks in our minds is this final press conference where this one East German official clearly doesn't know how to answer the questions of whether the wall is up, whether it's down, whether it's open, whether it's closed. And I think his kind of cluelessness is something that sort of sticks in the public imagination at that press conference. All right, I want to give you a kind of open question now, since we've kind of come up in this last question. We're talking about the end of the GDR, and this is one of them, kind of, I don't know, having spent a lot of time in Eastern Germany in my life, it's still a fairly sensitive topic about how the reunification with West Germany occurs. So can you give us kind of the Coles Notes brief-ish version of how that happens? How do you make one state out of two that are so entirely different from one another in so many ways?
Yeah, I mean, as you know, you just said with that press conference, the wall was sort of inadvertently opened on the 9th of November, 1989. I mean, the authorities had already realized that if they don't open it, you know, something really bad's going to happen. And they had no more Soviet backing. Gorbachev, the leader of the USSR, had already told the East German government there wouldn't be Soviet tanks this time, you're on your own. And so when these mass sort of demonstrations begin to escalate in the autumn of 1989, the wall eventually gets open, and that was the plan anyway. It's just that Gunter Schabowski and the government spokesperson in the press conference wasn't supposed to say that it was going to be open right now, because the border guards had absolutely no idea what to do with that. You know, should they still check passports, or you know, can people just go? It was supposed to open the next morning at 10 o'clock, and then they would have had clear instructions as to what to do. But since the wall was now no longer, you know, functioning effectively, keeping people in and out, there was already a free kind of flow, if you will, from East Germans over to the West. And you would have ended up in the same situation that East Germany was in the 1950s, where, you know, you get this like brain drain effectively of middle class people westwards because they effectively get better economic conditions over there. So it was clear that wasn't sustainable. And at that point, because of the kind of intransigence and the stubbornness of the regime, it was also clear that there wasn't going to be kind of reform, if you will, from the government in East Germany, which many people still wanted to reform the system rather than get rid of it completely. But eventually, over the spring of 1990, it moved in that direction, that two states would be made out of one. And the West, so West Germany, said from the outset, even though the SPD, the Social Democratic Party in West Germany, was against this as well, that there wouldn't be a new constitution or any sort of merger of the two. It was always going to be the case that East Germany becomes part of the West German system. They actually said that outright. They said, we have a constitution, we have a state, you can join it or leave it. And that was basically the, you know, kind of basis of the whole thing. So many East Germans felt that they'd lost everything that they built up over this time. I mean, there was jubilance. People wanted to go and visit their relatives and buy consumer goods in West Germany and all the rest of it. But many people also felt at the same time they had lives, you know, that they built up over this 40-year period. Or even if you were 20 at the time, you know, this is your life. This is what you knew. And suddenly your qualifications, for instance, weren't worth anything because they weren't done in the same way. So if you were, say, I don't know, a teacher, they would now say to you, well, you trained to be a teacher in East Germany. They use completely different methods from what we use. Your degree doesn't count anymore. So you may have been teaching for like a decade or longer. And they'd still send you back to university and say to you, you have to retrain. And then it was often West Germans who'd suddenly move into those positions and tell you how to do things, you know, and that just creates this kind of situation of what Germans called the Besser Wissi, you know, this kind of idea of the Westerner who knows everything better, the smarty pants Western person versus the stupid East German, you know, and this kind of this creation of this imbalance, I think psychologically and economically stuck with a lot of people. It felt humiliating. Many people genuinely lost their jobs. So, you know, even in the early 2000s, you still have a fifth of East Germans unemployed. That's slowly getting better now, but it's largely kind of gig economy type jobs that have moved in, and it just makes the statistics effectively look better, but it's still a precarious unemployment for lots of people. There was still a massive drain of people. So East Germany still has this problem now, and lots of people moving away, moving westwards. So you end up with this imbalance and with the idea that this was a takeover. There's actually a bestseller that came out a couple of years ago, which was literally called the Takeover, about German reunification, which he kind of made that sort of case that this wasn't a merger or a reunification, it was a takeover. People still speak of the five East German states as the new states. You know, if you're in Brandenburg or in Saxony, you're like, well, new to who? You know, I've lived here for so long. So, you know, there's certainly a sense that this was done to East Germans rather than with them, I think, and that lasts to this day.
And I think one of the elements of that, right, is how the West German authorities decided to deal with privatizing state property in the East, because there's a lot of infrastructure, there are factories, there's all sorts of things that belong to the East German state, and now they've got to be somehow brought into the market economy. And they set up this organization, this Treuhand organization by the West Germans, to do this. But this is not really done in an ethical way, as far as I understand. Can you talk a bit about how they dealt with all the state property?
Yeah, I mean, it's the same in the Soviet Union when that collapsed shortly after. There was a huge kind of frenzy. Many experienced this as like a bargain basement, you know, a grubby sort of sellout, really, of the entire economy. So, for instance, one of the people that I interviewed, Mani Rudard, who kind of, you know, was a normal working class East German, basically worked in different jobs, also along the border as a civilian sort of transport guy. And his job in 1990 was suddenly to put all of the machinery, like, you know, kind of farm machinery and sort of industrial vehicles and things like this, assemble them back together so that they could be sold for almost no money whatsoever to West Germans, who would kind of take them and then just use them for scrap metal. So you're kind of disassembling your actual job. You know, many people were in this kind of really awkward position where you're packing up your own workplace so that it could be sold often for the symbolic value of just one mark, literally one mark, you know, for an entire work complex, if you will. So, you know, these kind of companies that, that East Germany owned. And this was a huge, you know, again, economic problem, but also psychological problem in that it was done so quickly and so haphazardly. There was so much corruption going on at the same time that it felt to many that, you know, that their country was effectively sold out. And then people were told afterwards, you know, as they're made unemployed or kind of put into really precarious low-wage employment, that they shouldn't complain because after all, they've got it much better now than they did. And this, you know, just added to the sense that this situation lost many people their agency, their ability to kind of create their own life situation. Many people felt helpless as they kind of watched on, you know, as their country was sold out.
Do you think it's possible? Do you think I'm going to go for a bit of a counterfactual here, which I know is the kind of historian's bane in a way, but there was this.
We like the way.
Okay, thank you for saying that, because officially, I always have to say no, it's not how we do things. But like, they're super interesting in any case. And the one I was thinking of is there's this plan that West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl had in 1990. Which was like a 10-year integration plan, which of course then didn't get implemented. And there was this helter-skelter kind of integration or lack thereof that, that you described here and also in the book. Do you think that if that plan had been stuck to, or there was an attempt to stick to this longer-term integration plan, that the reunification could have gone better? Or was the gap socially and economically just so gaping that there was no real way to make it work?
Well, I think it was a really complex situation. I mean, people forget now that Helmut Kohl was in a lot of political trouble at the time, and it looked like he was going to lose the next election. You already had very bad election results in the last one. There are lots of corruption scandals going on. So unification for him was a political opportunity to rescue his own career and to rescue the his party, the CDU, from, you know, electoral collapse. So it had to happen quickly. He needed something to show for very quickly in order to deal with his own situation. So that was one thing. I think the market forces behind it, you know, you suddenly have huge, powerful lobbyists and kind of companies in the West who are seeing an opportunity here to buy up this entirely state-run or nearly entirely state-run economy. Is also not to be underestimated. I mean, you know, that would have been quite something to try and stop people from doing that, I think, when nobody in the East was in a position to do anything about it because the government was basically invalidated with the election in 1990. And on top of that, I think it was just too tempting, like, to not use this exuberance of the wall opening. You know, people, these images went around the world of kind of happy East Germans buying Walkmans and exotic fruit in West Berlin. To not use this kind of psychological effect of that and say, well, now let's make that a political reality, I think was also too good to let go. And so I think the problem was more that Kohl overpromised a lot. I mean, people did say, well, what about my job? What, you know, what's going to happen? And in the build-up to these elections in the spring of 1990, there was a lot of kind of promises along the lines of, don't worry, the state will step in, there won't be unemployment. If there is, we'll find you a new job, we'll retrain, we'll set up lots of funding schemes, like the solidarity tax, for instance, that actually came in, all of these things. So people just imagined, you know, that the state was going to help out. Like, they were always used to this. There was never the fear in East Germany that you could actually lose your job. That just didn't exist because there was full employment. And so I don't think East Germans were in a position then to judge what was going to happen because they'd never lived in a social market economy or in capitalism, if you will. And so they didn't understand the risk, I don't think, that came with that. You see the West through like this window of consumerism. You know, you watch like West German television, you listen to the radio, your West German relatives won't tell you, you know, sometimes like they go and buy the groceries that they send you at Aldi because they can't afford to go to a different supermarket and things like this. So then suddenly you're in this very real situation where you have to deal with the risks that come with capitalism, and you're in an lopsided position because your economy isn't set up for it. So it's hard to see how all of that could have been done in a calm, measured, non-selfish sort of way when actually, you know, you are integrating a socialist economy into a capitalist one, and the forces that come with that, I think, would have been too strong to hold back.
Yeah, and I think another part of that transition is, you know, entering a democracy or becoming a democracy after having been a dictatorship, and not only a dictatorship, but one of the most intense in terms of the surveillance state that there's ever been. So how did the reunification work in terms of these repressive state organs like the Stasi or the police and so on? Were they granted amnesty, or also the network of informants, which was a very substantial chunk of the East German population? So how did reunification work with police, with Stasi agents, with regular East Germans who were informing on people who they knew, who they worked with, or even in their families? Like, how was that handled?
Well, that was really tricky. I mean, from the off, there was a question, you know, do you go down the route of punishing everyone? In which case, you, as you just said, you would have punished like virtually a substantial part of the population. Or do you go for more of an amnesty? Well, you know, this was just the way that things were, and let's go for a kind of reintegration rather than that. And I think it's interesting that the brunt of the anger in 1989 was actually targeted at the Stasi. You know, you see people storming these offices, trying to halt the destruction of documents that was going on there. But like Erich Mielke, the head of the Stasi, was one of the first people to be ousted from power by his own regime, if you will, you know, by the authorities themselves. And we were trying to quickly reform things before they could be abolished. But of course, it was too late at this point to do that. And so the Stasi needed to go, and everybody knew that. And there was no way, you know, they quickly tried renaming it and kind of just giving it a different image. That was not going to happen. So this created an interesting situation, because it not only did the Stasi have 91,000 employees, full-time employees themselves, but on top of that, they had basically citizen spies, like ordinary people who spied on other ordinary people, so-called EMs or IMs, informants. So what to do with them, you know, in terms of, this could be like your colleague, your neighbor, your wife, for that matter, you know, who spied on you and was kind of passing information on to the state. So the decision was made that anybody could ask for their own Stasi file and request access to it. And you could then, I mean, it's not always obvious who the person was that informed on you. Sometimes the names were blacked out, for example, for sort of data protection reasons. Quite often you could work it out from that. And this caused quite a lot of social upheaval. You know, you'd kind of read your file. You'd read somebody else describing your own life in their words, and you'd see from the type of information that they had that this was, say, your colleague who may also have been your friend for years and years. And you know, this created all sorts of interesting psychological problems. But on the flip side, there's a huge, and this is the majority actually, a huge amount of Germans, East Germans, who just don't want to know, either because they genuinely don't care, but they see it as part of the system and it was just the way it was. Like, I've been trying to get my dad to request his own Stasi file for years, and he just says, I know what's in it, it was my life, what's the point? You know, and just doesn't go and request it. And I think that's a lot of people as well who just drew a line there in 1990 and said, you know what, I don't want to end up like being bitter and lose my friends, my neighbors, my colleagues over this. It was just a thing. A lot of people were coerced or kind of made to do this as well, as in the sense that, you know, you'd get like career advancements or whatever, and you'd be in a difficult position now where you're trying to decide whether you still want to be friends with them or not. So many East Germans just said, you know what, this is over, this is history, now let's move on.
Yeah, geez, the lives of others, to quote a famous movie title that's related to that topic, can be a complicated thing, no question. I want to ask a question about the legacy of the GDR. I mean, the book is about the history of the GDR, but the history of the GDR is also a part of, should be, in theory, a part of today's Germany's public consciousness. But in some ways, it's not quite as present as you might think it would be, having been a third of the country for 40 years, having had this different experience. And two things kind of made me think about that recently. One was, there's a German TV program, for those of you among our listeners who don't know, ZDF Heute. It's like a political kind of comedy program. And they did a little skit about difficult moments in German history. And they had these characters from certain years describing, oh, you think you have things hard in 2022, right? Well, look what we have in the Weimar Republic, or in this or that or that. And they had a character there from 1952 and 1973, and the character was West German. There was no such thing as East Germany in this little... Now, of course, I'm making a big deal about a small comedy sketch, but I feel like those small things can reveal these kind of blind spots. So what is the kind of ripple effect? What do Germans think about this GDR that came and went? Where does it fit in German historical consciousness?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I'm trying to do with this book is try and lift this chapter of German history up to exactly that, a chapter of German history. At the moment, I feel it is more of a footnote. As you say, you know, you talk of Germany in, say, 1973, and people think West Germany immediately, outside of it and inside of Germany. And it doesn't help, of course, that there's fewer East Germans than West Germans. Even today, it's about a fifth of the population that lives in the former East German territories. And so it is a minority, and that's, of course, then easier to ignore. But on top of that, you also end up now even still in a situation where the government, the people in charge of media, anybody who kind of forms public opinion, the vast majority are West Germans, and East Germans are vastly underrepresented. I want to say there's two ministers at the moment from East Germany. The rest of the government is entirely West German dominated as well. So this is not necessarily a malicious thing, I don't think, or deliberate as such, but it is just not on people's radar. And that's part of the reason, I think, why so many East Germans, two-thirds according to recent opinion polls, still see themselves or think they are treated as second-class citizens because of their background. Many East Germans, when they go in the West to West Germany to study or to work, won't even say that they're from the former East because they fear it comes with these sort of cliches of being stupid, being a little bit naive, and, you know, that kind of sort of cliche of the Aussie that's still very much around. And when I traveled to Bavaria in the 1990s, I met a Bavarian there who said to me, you can't quite decide whether it's worse that I'm a Prussian or an Aussie. So he couldn't quite make his mind up which of the two was the bigger problem. And I thought, brilliant. So next time I just keep my broad Berlin accent to myself and speak in proper High German, then you might know where I'm from. So, you know, this is very much still a thing. And West Germany remains the sort of continuity state, whilst East Germany is the anomaly. If it's mentioned, it's mentioned as an, oh, in the East this happened, you know, kind of as an add-on. It's not an equal part, if you will, of this. And this is because 1990 wasn't a turning point for West Germans. It was a turning point for East Germans. They joined something that already existed. And this has never kind of left, I think, people's consciousness.
Yeah, I think that was an interesting detail as well in the book, that West Germans are more likely to talk about the reunification, whereas East Germans are more likely to phrase it as Die Wende, right? So this turning point or change. And there is something to be said, there's something revealing, I think, in that difference. But one former East German who did make it to the top of the heap, so to speak, is, of course, former Chancellor Angela Merkel. Now, since she stepped down as Chancellor, she has come under a lot of criticism, or her policy has come under a lot of criticism, her policy towards Russia and relations with Russia, economic and so on. How much do you think her roots in the East, having come from the East, might have had an impact on her real persistent desire to accommodate Russia even after it annexed Crimea in 2014?
Yeah, I mean, much has been made of that because she, of course, speaks Russian. We all learned, I still learned Russian at school all the way up to A-level, you know, so this is very much part of the way that you grew up. And I think this still shows as well in the attitude attitudes of lots of East Germans towards this conflict. You know, when you break it down into East and West German attitudes, you find that East Germans are much, much more likely to say, you know, there needs to be peace and we need to rebuild relations with Russia. And I think that's partially down to the fact that you grow up reading Russian literature, you might have traveled there as part of a school exchange program, you had Russian pen pal. So it's harder for us to sort of see Russia as the other, you know, because they are effectively individual people that you have in mind. When you think of Russians, you think of your school pal Sergei or whatever, you know, who was there when you were 13. But at the same time, I think it's too easy to say, you know, this is Angela Merkel herself, when actually you've got people like Gerhard Schröder, for example, from Lower Saxony, the chancellor before her, who's arguably, you know, a lot more pro-Russian and certainly a lot closer with Putin.
I think that's arguably. Sure.
I don't see that, you know, Angela Merkel would have enjoyed like sauna, you know, meetings with Putin in the way that Gerhard Schröder did. You know, I think it's a wider German problem. I want to say, you know, from my own point of view, that the idea that Russia is the kind of senior partner here over the Eastern European states, this is the serious power you got to talk to when you want to make politics in this part of the world. That's something I think that's very much ingrained in the German establishment overall, I think. that's not specifically an East German thing. There is, of course, as I say, a closer cultural affinity there, but that goes for Ukraine as well. You know, many of these people that I was just talking about in terms of pen pals from the Soviet Union, it's easy to forget that the Ukraine was part of it. And, you know, you ended up basically lots of people with Ukrainian pen pals. And, you know, it's often Russian-speaking Ukrainians who turn up now and find people that they know are related to in East Germany to live with and to stay there. Lots of the refugees ended up in the former East because people were happy to take them in because they still knew them or had links to them, either through like friendships or family relations. So I don't think this is a specific Eastern thing in Angela Merkel's policy. I think this is very much a kind of German establishment problem in both major political parties.
All right. Now, you've mentioned quite a few times your own personal experience having grown up in the former East Germany. So I want to end with a question about that. You talk about imagery a little bit at the end of the book in the context of personal memories. And I happened to stumble across a quote from an East German author, Christa Wolf. I bought one of her collections of short stories at a flea market when I was learning German, thinking, oh yeah, I'm gonna... And I...
Oh God, good luck to you.
Yeah.
It's not an easy
read. I ended up reading it like 10 years later and it wasn't my thing. But anyway, Christa Wolf, she apparently said that East Germany was a gray country, but its people were able to see colors within the gray. And then you also kind of talk about colors and sensory attachments to East Germany at the end of the book. When you're talking about these personal memories, you talk about the green peppermint liqueur. I think you also tweeted about it. It was pretty brilliant green. What else did you write about? The smell of a common disinfectant or the sound of a Trabant engine, which to my untrained ear sounds like a lawnmower. But that's another story.
It goes...
So now you don't say this specifically in the book, but are those, you know, your child, little Katya's memories of the GDR? Like how much of your personal experience informed the book?
Yeah, I mean, I was still a child when the wall came down, you know, so I'm in no position as such to talk about kind of really clear memories. They're very kind of, as you say, sensory, kind of childhood type memories. Although having said that, many of these things didn't just vanish. You know, you can still walk into a supermarket in East Germany today and find many of said, you know, peppermint liqueur, for example. I still have it when I go back to Germany now because it's just a thing that remained. You know, same with the Trabants, they didn't suddenly all vanish. Many people sold theirs, but many people didn't. And so they were still around for a long time and still are, actually, because they, you know, they're kind of like a collector's item now and people restore them. So I would say that plays a role because you grow up with these things as normal, whereas they tend to be exotic or frowned upon or come with like certain ideas elsewhere. And this, I often get that when people, you know, you say you're German, people say East or West still today in, you know, foreign countries, and you say, well, from the former East, and then people immediately go into these, you know, questions like, what was it like, and what was the food like, and what was this and that like, and they have very kind of preconceived ideas. So say, for instance, both of my parents were in full-time employment because that was just the way that almost every family worked. So I was perfectly used to the idea of coming home from primary school at like lunchtime with my own key in my hand, you know, at sort of 6-7 years old. And that was just normal. And you'd kind of grow up, I suppose, in a different way as a result of that, because you're kind of more independent earlier. You haven't got this very firm family structure in at home in the way that, say, West German kids would grow up with their mother at home up until they kind of go to secondary school, at least. So these structures remained. My parents were a lot younger than most West Germans' parents were because the structures were there to support them. So people had their children younger. So my mom, for instance, was only, I think, 21, 22 when she had me still at university. This is kind of unthinkable now, you know, to do like full-time studies and then have a tiny newborn child with you in the student accommodation. Whilst, you know, they actually had like mother-child kind of setups there with childcare facilities and these things. So these structures outlasted the GDR and they shaped me, I suppose. And one of the things I'm trying to do with this book is explain to other people, you know, how these things were to people that lived there. And I think the fact that I'm from this background and grew up with people who experienced it and kind of were born in the GDR themselves has certainly shaped the book because I don't have an outsider's perspective as such on it. But I can see how an outsider would view it, having lived in the UK for so long and having only been a child myself when the wall came down. So I think it's this kind of hybrid perspective that helps explain things to people, I hope.
Yeah, well, I couldn't put it any better myself. I think that kind of reflects the journey that I went on when I read the book, and also maybe even this podcast, because we started off with these caricatures of Stasi and muscular swimmers, and here we are hearing about your personal life and someone who experienced this state and its aftermath and was affected by it. So I can heartily recommend the book to all of you listening out there. It's called Beyond the Wall, East Germany, 1949 to 1990. And we're going to put a link where you can get it if you're interested in ordering it underneath wherever this podcast is posted. Katja Heuer, thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing your story and East Germany's story.
Thanks, Jesse. It was great to be back.
The Real Time History Podcast is a production of Real Time History. I'm your host, Jesse Alexander, and each episode is produced by Philip Janssen. If you listen to this podcast on Nebula or Patreon, thank you so much for the support. We couldn't produce the show without you. I'll see you in the next episode.